All right, so welcome to 677. My name is Prashant. I'll be the instructor for this course. So what I'm going to do today is to give all of you a quick introduction to what this course is about, why we care about distributed systems, and hopefully get a little bit of your input on why you are interested in this course. Now, I know that several of you sent me an email in the past couple of weeks asking about registering for this course. So if you haven't yet registered because Spire wouldn't let you in or you hadn't made up your mind or anything like that, I have override forms here which I will sign at the end of the class and you should be able to get in. I don't expect that there will be any problems in letting most of you in. We have enough room in the course, so that shouldn't be an issue. Okay. So let's get started here. So I'm going to first talk a little bit about the syllabus for this course and some administrivia. So my office, I will be having office hours for this course throughout the semester to answer your questions or talk about any aspect of the class. My office hours will be Thursdays 12:30 to 1:30. So right after the Thursday lecture, I will have my office hours. Okay. There is a TA for this course. He was supposed to be here, so he may walk in sometime during the lecture and I will introduce you to him. His name is Vimal Matthew. You don't have to write any of this down. It's all on the course webpage. So are these slides. That's his email address, phone number. He will have office hours twice a week. Okay, Mondays and Fridays from 3 to 4 on Mondays, 2:30 to 4 Fridays. Okay, it will be in this building, like my office is also in this building. His office is in room 266, that's where he's going to be sitting. Again, he is an important resource for this course, okay, as far as we'll talk about programming assignments and projects and whatnot. So he will be usually your first line of contact if you have problems with any aspect of the programming assignment, things are not working, the ed lab, there are problems. So you talk to him. I'm always available, of course, but some of these details he can also help you with. Okay, so keep that in mind. Okay, there is a web page for this course. Okay, so that's the URL. That's about the only thing you really need to remember. Everything else you can access off the web page. So typically you can go to my page and it's linked off my page, or you can just write this down. Let me see if I can show you the page very quickly. So everything I'm going to hand out in this course or talk about will be available off this page. So here is the course syllabus that I'm talking about is linked off the page. All of the lecture notes are also posted. So today's lecture should already be on there. So you can see that there is a link there with the PDF of the slides I'm showing you. I also record my classes as I'm doing right now. So I will put up audio feeds of these lectures on the web page and also make that available as a podcast. There are instructions on the page how to access it. Okay, so if you happen to miss a class or you want to review the material, it's a good way to go back and look. Okay. Now this is not an excuse to stop coming to class because everything is online. You shouldn't assume that you should stop coming to class. There are important discussions we'll have here. Once in a while you may do in-class exercises, so it's a good idea to always keep up with the class and actually attend. Okay, so course webpage. So the topics that we will cover in the course are listed on this slide. So we'll start with the introduction of distributed systems, what they are, define what a distributed system is, talk about pros and cons of distributed systems, and just give you some examples of lots of distributed systems that you encounter in practice. Okay, so that's basically what we are going to do today. Starting next class, we will actually start looking at more in-depth topics. We'll start with distributed architectures. Okay, what are sort of architectures that are used to design systems of distributed systems of various kind. That will be the baseline that you will need for all of the remaining topics in this course. and they are as follows. We will talk first about communication, so inter-process communication or communication between components of a distributed system is an important issue. So we'll look at how you can write applications or systems that enable this communication. So we look at remote procedure calls, remote method invocations, message and stream oriented communication. They're all very general but commonly used techniques for communication within a distributed system. Okay. Then we will talk about scheduling of and processes, threads and scheduling within distributed system. We look at the concept of what is a thread, how it differs from a process. How do you go about scheduling threads? We look at, use that as the basis to understand the notion of migration, code and process migration within a distributed system. Okay. And we'll also cover this slightly more advanced topic of virtualization, which is often used in the context of migration. Okay. If these things don't make sense or the terms are not known, don't worry about it. This is just an overview of the topics. As we will go into more detail in each, you will know more about them. Okay. So naming and location management is next. So look at global naming systems, how they are distributed. Look at examples like the domain name system of the DNS and see how they are constructed. Okay. And try to understand how do you do naming in large scale distributed system. The next topic is actually one of the more in-depth topics we'll cover in the course. A good, maybe a quarter of the course is actually going to be focused on that topic, which is titled Canonical Problems and Solution. Okay. So what this means is basically in this topic we will look at all of the nuts and bolt techniques that are used in designing any large distributed system. Okay. These are common issues that arise in any large-scale distributed system. Things like mutual exclusion, okay, leader election, synchronization, distributed transactions. So all of these we will study in a more abstract in this topic. And then as we go along, we will instantiate it in the context of specific systems or artifacts. Okay. So we'll spend quite a bit of time trying to understand these basic principles that underlie any distributed system. And then we will again switch back to more applied topics. So we'll go and look at resource sharing, replication, consistency. So replication, caching, these are important topics for enhancing performance in any distributed system. We will look at fault tolerance and security. Okay, how do you make your system tolerate faults that occur in the system? How do you ensure that the system is secure, not vulnerable to security and privacy attacks? We'll look at all of those. And then there will be some advanced topics starting with distributed middleware. Okay. Then we'll look at the World Wide Web, the new topics such as cloud computing, green computing, multimedia, time permitting. So I don't think we can cover all of these, but we can cover several of these. Depends on how quickly we can cover the other topics. So that's a rough outline of what the course is going to look like as well. Okay. We will cover these topics in this order. This is the same order as the chapters you have in the book, which I will show you in just a moment. Okay. So that's basically what you should expect. Some of these advanced topics are not in the book. I will make reading material available for them for these topics as well as some supplementary material for the rest. Okay. Just so that you can read both the book as well as these other things to keep up with the class. Okay. So let me come to the book. The book is same as what we have used for a number of years. Okay, Distributed Systems by Tannenbaum and Steen. Okay, this is the second edition of the book that came out about a year and a half back. Okay, so that's the recommended edition that you should use. You are welcome to use an older edition if you so wish. There isn't that much that has changed. There are some topics that have changed. Okay. So it's recommended that you use the new one, but if you have an older copy and want to use that, that's fine. It would be your responsibility to make sure you have the new material that we will cover. Okay. So as I said, it's not a whole lot, but there is a little bit. Okay. So the TA has just come. So this is Vimal Matthew. As I said, he's going to be our TA. So I already mentioned your office hours and so on. Okay. So as I said, he's important person, resource for the course. Make sure you talk to him as and when you have questions. Also come talk to me if Vimal cannot address some issue or for any other purpose. Okay. So thanks for stopping by. Okay, so that's the book. There are some other things, the other suggested reading material, but you don't really have to purchase those. We'll make those available online. As far as the grades are concerned, the way we structure this course is there is a combination of homeworks, programming assignments, and exams. Okay. So there are 4 to 5 homeworks, typically 4, but sometimes 5, depends on how we break it up. That constitutes around 20% of the grade. Okay. And this is just to force you to keep up with the course. You'll see that we basically cover topics at a relatively fast pace. So if you basically don't keep up with the textbook, you will fall behind very quickly. And this is a good way to make you read the material in the book, because the homework directly relate to in-class discussions and the material that's in the book. Okay. So that's the homeworks. And we have three to four, but typically three programming assignments. Okay. That's around a third or 35% of your grade. Okay. I'll talk more about that in just a moment. And then there are two exams, a midterm, which will be an in-class midterm, somewhere towards the second half of this course. Okay. And a final, which is typically a take-home final, okay, usually in just before the week of the finals. Okay. And that's about 40% of the grade. Okay. 5% freebies just for asking questions, okay, in-class participation. Okay. So that's how the your grade is going to be structured. Any questions on this? Okay. So there is a course mailing list that's listed there. Okay. You will be automatically added as you register. Okay. If you're already registered, you're already on it. If you're not, as soon as you add, Spire adds you to the list. So you don't really have to worry about getting on the list, but keep an eye on out for announcement. I will send all of the course announcements in addition to posting them on the webpage. Also use the mailing list to disseminate this information quickly. Okay. Typically Spire adds your university email address. Okay. Whatever that is registered with Spire, that's where you will receive this announcement. Okay. If you read email elsewhere, make sure you forward your mail. Okay. So that you get all of the announcements. Okay. There are some background we have assumed you will have. Okay. This is not strictly enforced. Okay, let me say that at the off. But you are assumed to have this background. So, undergraduate course in operating system, it's assumed that you know something about operating system in order to learn about distributed system. So that's the material you will build on. Okay. If you haven't formally taken a class, make sure you can keep up with the course. And as and when you have certain deficiencies in your background, you need to go and read the material from an undergraduate class. Because I will assume that you know something about this. So as you will see, we don't enforce it in Spire or anywhere else. Okay, so it's just self-enforcement that you have to do. Okay, the other thing you need to know is some programming. Okay, so all of the assignments the programming assignment that I talked about will involve non-trivial amount of programming. Some of which you can do as groups. Okay, we will allow you to form groups of two. But you need to know some programming language. Again, we don't enforce a particular choice of a language. If you want to do it in Java, C, C++, Python, it's really up to you. Okay? You need to choose the language carefully. And you can do the assignments in the language of your choice. Okay, we may suggest some language, but we will not enforce it. And the reason for this is, as you design a distributed system, okay, if you actually go out and someday go and design a large distributed system, the choice of the language is also in many cases up to the designers. Okay, you have to pick the language for the same reasons. Here you have to choose a language of your choice. Okay, this is, so you can pick one that you are familiar with, you can learn a new one that has good features for distributed programming. It's up to you. Okay, but you need to know something, okay, that will work for this course. Okay, any questions on this? Does anyone need a hard copy of the syllabus? Technically, I am required to give you all hard copies, but in the interest of being green, I have posted everything on the web page. Okay, so if you need something, let me know. And I will assume that all of this is already on the page, so you don't have to write anything down. Okay, so with that background, I'm going to, or rather that overview of the syllabus, I'm going to now give you a little bit of intuition for what this course is about, why do we care about distributed systems and so on. So you may or may not have realized this, but most of the computing systems that you encounter today are distributed in some shape or form. Okay? This is everything from the web to Google to online retailers like Amazon.com, peer-to-peer file sharing systems, Nutella, BitTorrent, what have you, systems like SETI at home, grid cluster computing, or practically any modern network computer. Now the reason they are distributed is that today's applications are themselves distributed. Okay, components of these applications run on different machines. These components interact with one another to achieve some goal. Okay, so you will see that that's the common way, the common technique that is used to design today's real world system. And so if you want to understand the basic principles that underlie this system, you have to learn about what are distributed systems and how they work. Okay, so so by doing so, you also gain some insight into how these larger systems are built today. Okay, so what this course is going to do is cover basic principles that underlie some of these distributed systems, and that's basically what you will use to gain some insights into the design of the system. Now, as you may realize, when you interact with some of the systems, you don't even know that they are distributed. Okay? So, for instance, you go to Google and you type in a search query. Okay? What is happening in the back to get you your search results? You don't know. Okay? Neither should you know, and it's all hidden from you. But yet there is a very sophisticated large system of machines that are in the background, that are processing your search query, that are providing search results and doing whatever else it takes for Google to be Google. Okay? Now that's a good example of a distributed system. You're interacting with a system without knowing any of the internal details of how the system works. The Google may have 20,000 machines that are basically powering their search engine, but you don't know where these machines are, how they work. All of that is hidden from you. So as far as you, the user, is concerned, you just go to this web page and type in a search query, and then it returns you search results. And that's a good way, good example of how to build a large distributed system. The more you can hide from your end users, the better off you are in terms of making this system useful to your users. Okay? The more you need the user to know in order to make the system work, the more complicated you have made the system for this end user. And we'll talk about this in a more formal way. But this is just one example of actually using a distributed system without knowing any of the details of what the system really does in the back. Okay? Okay, so before we move further, let's just define what we mean by a distributed system. Okay, so here is basically a definition. A distributed system is basically, think of it as multiple connected cores or CPUs that work together in some form. Okay, or you could think of it as a collection of independent computers, okay, that appear to its users as a single coherent system. So if you take some number of computers, you connect them using some fashion, typically using a network, okay, and this collection essentially presents an abstraction of a single logical entity in some shape or form, we will call that a distributed system. Okay. Now there are many examples or many flavors of distributed system that go all the way from parallel machines or multi-core machines to network machine. Okay, we'll see the whole spectrum in a bit. Okay. And for the purposes of our course, we'll accept all of them as some form of a distributed system. Okay. Except for what we will call very tightly coupled parallel machines, which we will exclude from our definition of a distributed system. Practically any other collection of CPUs that work together in some form, okay, we'll accept as a distributed system. So this is a very broad, loose definition, and there's a reason for that, as we'll see. Okay. Now, having defined what is a distributed system, let's try to understand what they give us, okay, and what are some disadvantages. So, what do you think are advantages of a distributed system. There are several listed on this slide, but as we will go and sort of as we look at this in more depth, you will see that the primary advantage of connecting, so you may ask, why should we actually take all of these CPUs or machines and connect them together? What do we get by doing so fundamentally?
You have more power, like you can do things that a single computer couldn't possibly do.
Right.
Like Google search engine is a good example for that.
Right. So the reason you are connecting these machines up is you want to do something that you couldn't do with a single machine. If you could do that with a single machine, there's no reason to connect multiple machines together. Okay, so you want to harness the resources that are available on multiple machines to do something. Okay? And that is precisely what is the primary advantage of a distributed system. It makes resource sharing possible. It allows you to take resources on independent machines, independent processors, and somehow harness them to do something, to power an application or to achieve some task. Right? That's one thing. The other thing which comes with that is that it also enables communication. Right? Harnessing resources involves that these machines be somehow able to interact with one another. Okay, if they're independent entities that don't talk to one another, you haven't really achieved anything. Okay? So what comes with resource sharing is the ability to communicate between these resources or across machines. So these are two important things that a distributed system makes possible. It enables communication across machine and it enables resource sharing. Right? So this is really the primary reason why you build distributed systems at all. Right? Because you want to do something that wouldn't be possible with a single machine. Right? But there are many other advantages. Okay? So the economics is another advantage. Okay? So by harnessing resources on inexpensive machines, you can get a better price performance ratio than buying a smaller, but a more expensive symmetric multiprocessor, for instance. Okay? So rather than buying an expensive mainframe computer, okay, you can get lots of inexpensive servers and hook them together, and then you get a similar, better performance for a lower price. Okay? So economics is another big driver for a distributed system. Okay. And you get lots of other benefits, some of which are listed here, reliability and scalability. Okay. If you design your application well, the failure of some components of your system shouldn't take down the whole application. Okay. So you get higher availability, better reliability, because you can tolerate some faults in the system while other machines continue to function, your application can continue to function. Okay. There's potential for incremental growth. As we will see, is another important advantage. You can, as your application grows over time, because there are more users or there's more data, you can incrementally grow the system. Okay? And that's an important advantage. It's not something we'll talk about a whole lot, but I think that's a very attractive thing, because you don't have to go and buy a single large box upfront. You can buy a small cluster and grow it over time, for instance. Okay. Now, although there are several of these advantages, there are many disadvantages of a distributed system over what we will call a centralized system. Okay. Because you have multiple machines that interact with one another, okay, you need to have programming languages that you can use to write this distributed application. These languages may either be more complex or may require you to use more complex features that you wouldn't have to use if you are writing a standalone centralized program. Okay? So your programming languages need to be distribution aware or have capabilities that allow you to write a distributed application. This involves everything from socket programming, inter-process communication, remote procedure calls. All of the features that you would use in a language to write a distributed application makes the application itself more complex. Okay? The underlying operating system also has to be distribution aware. It needs functionality that allows these distributed applications to share resources and communicate with one another. Okay? So the OS also becomes more complicated, and as I just mentioned, the applications themselves are more complex than a simpler centralized application. Okay? Network connectivity is essential in a distributed system. Okay? So if you don't have a network, you cannot write a distributed system or write a distributed application. Or more importantly, if your network fails, then that causes your application to fail in certain ways. Yeah, that's basically a disadvantage. Okay, so if you had a standalone application that was running on your laptop, that's written differently from a distributed application, and then failure of a network connectivity or a lack of network connectivity on your machine doesn't impact the correctness of that application. Okay, but if you don't have network access, your distributed application will not function because components cannot interact with one another. Okay. And yet another disadvantage is security and privacy. Okay. Because data is distributed on multiple machines, these systems are more vulnerable to security and privacy attacks. You may have read data getting stolen from machines. These are complex distributed applications that had some security loophole that somebody could exploit to get either data or break into a system and whatnot. Okay. Because these machines are on a network, someone remote somewhere, okay, can actually access resources on that machine, can break into a machine and steal data. That's what a distributed system makes possible. Okay, so it's a double-edged sword in some sense. Okay, you need all of this communication to write your application, but it also allows anyone else to also access your resources if they are not protected. Okay, so those are some advantages and disadvantages of a distributed system. Okay, now here is this, what this slide is basically showing you is how to write a good distributed system. I already gave you this example, this Google example, where I said you are interacting with a system that has hidden from you any aspect of it being distributed. As far as you're concerned, it just looks like you're talking to a web server, you send off a search query and it's returning results. Okay? All of the internal details are hidden from you. Okay. Now, what in a more formal sense, what this is enabling is what is referred to as transparency in a distributed system. If a distributed system can hide from its user the fact that it is distributed, or make it transparent to user the fact that it is distributed, then it is somehow more useful or provide better utility to its user. Okay. There are many forms of transparency. Okay. So I'm not going to go into all of these. Just to give you an example, what location transparency says is if you have a distributed system which hides the location of the resource from its users, then you have what is called location transparency. Okay. So a simple example is if you take URLs in the web world, okay, they are location transparent. Okay. If you say www.google.com, it doesn't reveal to you where is the Google server located. Okay, it may be on the west coast, it may be somewhere else. It's hidden from the user. Okay, the user need not know in order to access the Google search engine, and neither should they have to know in this case. Okay, that's an example of location transparency. Okay, replication transparency basically, as the name suggests, hides the fact that the system is replicated in some form. Okay. Again, an example of that is Google search engine. Right? Typically, Google uses tens of thousands of servers to power its search engine. Okay? Now, the fact that the Google search engine is replicated on these thousands of servers is hidden from the user. Okay? There is no way you know when you interact with the Google interface how many machines are basically powering the search engine. Okay, that's an example of replication transparency. If Google had an interface where it said go to the 1,000th server and fire off your search query, that would be an example of a system that is not replication transparent. Then you would have to say www.1000.google.com. Okay? Just to give you an example of a system that may not be replication transparent. Okay. And there are many others. So there is failure transparency, which says that if the system is designed to tolerate faults and can tolerate faults without exposing these faults to the user, that's failure transparency. And you have persistence and relocation and migration and whatnot. So we'll come back to these terms as we cover other topics. But what you should take away from this is not all of these individual terms, but the fact that a good distributed system, okay, is one that hides the fact that it's distributed in any form from its end user. Okay? This makes it more usable, okay? Because the user doesn't have to deal with the inherent complexity of either knowing the location of resources or the fact that they're replicated or the fact that they're concurrent, the fact that they may be moving from one location to another and so on. Is that clear? Any questions here? No question.
Wait, so in this case, transparency means hiding different aspects of the system from the user?
Yes.
And that's called transparency.
That is what transparency is.
Okay.
That's what we mean by transparent, the fact that it is hidden. Right. Any other questions here?
But isn't transparent, it doesn't transparent mean that you can really see through this, like in literal sense?
Yes, that transparency means you can see through, which means that what is in there is hidden from. That's what, I mean, it's it's a technical term. When you say something is transparent to a user, it means you hide that from the user. It's not visible to the user, which is why it's transparent. Okay? Okay. So, let's now talk about what are called open distributed system. Okay? So, as opposed to something that we will call a proprietary distributed system. Okay, an open distributed system is one that documents its interfaces, okay, and possibly its architecture. So basically any distributed system would offer some service to its end user. If that system can document either in by publishing its interface or publishing its API, how it interacts with either other applications or its end user, we will refer to that system as an open distributed system. Okay, so essentially what that means is that the syntax as well as the semantics of the protocols that are used in that distributed system are known a priori. Okay, so and they are not hidden from the end user. Okay, so what are some advantages of an open distributed system? Why should you publish the interface that is used to interact with your distributed application? What it enables is interoperability and portability. So if you publish the interface that you use for communication with your application, then someone else can write another application that conforms to that interface and uses that interface to interact with you. Okay? This enables interoperability. Okay? And the reason this is also called portable is someone can then use the same interface to re-implement that same functionality that may run on a different platform or a different architecture. Okay. So let me give you an example. Okay, so you may have heard of NFS or the network file system. Okay. So what NFS does is it allows you to access files that are stored on a different machine from your local workstation. Okay. NFS is referred to as an open distributed system. Okay, why is that? Because what NFS does, okay, or what the designers of NFS did, is that they wrote a spec or a specification that said any server that conforms to this spec will be a valid NFS server. So anybody can use this document to write their own NFS server or for that matter their own NFS client. Okay? So long as you use this protocol, okay, or this interface for your client, which is your workstation, to talk to that server, okay, you are using the NFS protocol. So what this allowed the others to do, okay, NFS was originally designed by Sun Microsystems, and we'll talk about NFS later on in this course. So what this allowed others to do was to write their own clients that could talk to a Solaris NFS server, okay, or a SunOS NFS server. And similarly, other operating system designers could write their own NFS server so that somebody else's client could talk to them. So what this has done is that if you actually have any system that supports NFS, it can talk to any NFS server, regardless of whether that server is running on Windows or Linux or Mac, Solaris, doesn't matter. Okay? Because the protocol is known and it's open, any system that says it complies with NFS is written to that spec, so it is basically portable and interoperable. Okay? This is an important advantage. If the NFS designers had not published the spec, so then what you would have is only Sun machines would be able to take advantage of the fact that you can actually have files that are stored on a remote machine and you can access them as if they were local, okay, which is what a distributed file system would allow you to do. Okay. So there are many protocols or distributed systems that are not open, that are proprietary in some shape or form. Okay. Original implementations of Real Player and Windows Media Player did not specify the protocol. Okay? So you couldn't write your own Windows Media compliant client unless you reverse engineered the protocol and figured out how that protocol works, there's no document you could go and download and say, this is the protocol, I just write my application to, or my media player to confirm this is protocol, and I can start streaming audio or video from some Windows media somewhere, server somewhere else. Okay? That was not done. And the reason for that is Microsoft, in this case, did not want anyone else to write Windows Media Client. They wanted to be the sole providers of the servers and clients. And that's how some applications are built. Whether it's good or bad, we will not argue the merits or the lack thereof in this course. But I just wanted to distinguish a system that is not open from one that is. Okay, and what are the pros and cons of either. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, so another issue that we will keep coming back to in this course is the scalability of your system. Okay? Since your system is distributed and it has a number of components, you can ask the question, how well does it scale as you incrementally grow it? If I have a cluster of 10 servers, let's say, okay, it has a certain capacity. If I add 10 more, okay, and you have some distributed application running there, what would be the total capacity of this newer, larger system? Okay. Will it be twice of what you had before? If so, your system scales linearly with the number of components, and that's a good thing. Right? But often that's not the case. As you add more resources, the capacity of your system does not grow linearly. It grows sublinearly, and sometimes it may actually go down instead of going back up. Okay. So what this says is you should design your algorithms, data structures, applications in a way so that they scale with the amount of hardware resources in your system. Okay. So there are many reasons you may not be able to scale well. Okay. And there are some that are listed here. If you basically centralize any aspect of your system, that will become a bottleneck in your system. Okay. As the number of users or as the workload on your application grows, that component is going to become a bottleneck, which means that it is basically the component that holds the whole system from scaling up. Okay? So if you have centralized services, then your system obviously doesn't scale. I mean, this is just a simple centralized application. But if you have a distributed application that uses some centralized data in some shape or form, then your system is not going to scale. Similarly, if you have centralized algorithm anywhere in your system, again you will not scale. So just to give you an example of a centralized data, imagine that Google has the Google search engine constructs an index of all of the web pages it crawls. Okay? So let's assume this whole index was stored on one machine, okay, somewhere in the Google system. And then it has a large array of servers where search queries are coming in. So what would then happen is whenever you fire a search query, it would go to one of the servers in the Google search engine, and that server would then go to the single machine to do a lookup, saying, tell me all pages that match CS677 UMass. Okay? So what do you think would happen in this incarnation of Google?
I mean, you'd be limited by the bottleneck of going to that one machine. So if there are 10,000 users, all 10,000 users have to wait to get the data from the one machine.
Right. So what you have here is what is called centralized data. What you did is you basically put all of your important data on one machine, and all other machines have to talk to that machine in order to process any user requests. Okay. So this machine is going to become a bottleneck. As the number of concurrent queries grows, this machine is going to get overloaded quickly. That's going to limit the throughput of the entire system. In other words, the system will not be able to scale once a centralized machine gets overloaded. Okay? And that's basically something you shouldn't do. Okay? And clearly Google doesn't do that. They take their index and they distribute it across all of their machines, so all search queries can run in parallel. Okay? But that's just one example. Okay, here you have an example of an online telephone book. Same principle. Okay? If you have a telephone directory and it just centralized on one machine, then that machine is going to become a bottleneck as the number of lookups on this telephone book grows, okay, with number of users. And same is true of centralized algorithm. Okay, this is more subtle, but we look at centralized algorithms as we consider other examples of distributed systems. So you don't want a bottleneck in your system for it to scale well. Okay, and this is easier said than done. There are all sorts of bottlenecks that you do not anticipate a priori that can arise in distributed systems. Okay. So what are some principles for scaling well? Okay. So what you want are some of these ideas to be instantiated in an application for it to scale with. So you want to make sure that no machine has complete state. Okay, so centralized data is an example of a single machine that has complete state, and so that becomes the bottle. So the more you distribute your state, the more scalable your system is going to be. Okay? You want as far as possible to make decisions based on local rather than global information. Okay? If your application needs to talk to all other components every time it has to process a request, that is quickly going to become a bottleneck. Because there will be so much communication in your system, because every component has to talk to every other component to process any request, and you will basically hit a performance bottleneck. So as far as possible, make decisions based on local information. Request comes in, you look at local files, you look at local memory state, process that request, send back a result. Okay? That's the easiest way to scale. So as you add more machines, each is going to scale without incurring any bottleneck in the system. Okay. The other thing is, how do you design the system to tolerate faults? In any large distributed system, failures are going to be the norm, not the exception. Okay. If you have a single laptop, failure is not the norm. Most of the time your laptop is assumed to function. Okay. Every once in a while something may happen, it may break down. Okay. This is not true in a distributed system. As the number of components in your system grows, the probability of failure also grows. Okay. There's a simple laws that you basic simple rules from probability. Let's just say the probability of any component failing in your system is P. Okay? If your n component, well, assume that components fail independently. There are n components. What's the probability that there is a failure in the system? I cannot hear somebody saying something. Okay.
It's just P power n.
Yeah. So probability that there is a failure, okay, is 1 minus the probability that there is no failure, right? Because what's the probability that there is a failure? The probability that there is a failure is the probability that either one component fails, two component fails, three component fails, n component fails. Okay? So basically one, so let's minus p to the power n. P to the power n is the probability that some component has failed. Right? So this is the probability that there is a failure in the system. Okay? As n grows, let's say n grows to infinity, this is going to go to 0. Because this is a number less than 1. Okay? So the probability that there is a failure is going to start approaching 1 in the system. Okay? Or put another way, assume that you have 1,000 servers. Okay? What are the chances that some server is going to fail? As the number of server grows, that the probability is going to start approaching 1 quickly. Because something is going to go wrong somewhere. Okay? So, in other words, in a large distributed system, some components will have failed at any given point in time. Okay? So you want your application as a whole to continue to function regardless of the presence of failures. In other words, you have to build in the fact that some machines are going to be down at any given time. Okay. And if this is not part of your system, then your application will stop functioning if that system fails. Okay. So Google is a good example again. I mean, at any given time, hundreds of Google nodes may be down for one reason or another, down for maintenance, down because there's a hardware fault, or down because the system crashed or something happened. Okay. System as a whole doesn't go down. Okay. Any good system should have this property. If you use Twitter, you will see that's an example of something that does not follow. Because some failure actually brings the system down, and this happens frequently. This is because they have not built in the fact that nodes are going to fail or something is going to go wrong, and yet you want to your application as a whole to continue to function. So this is something you have to keep in mind. I mean, this is not something you think of when you write your application. What would happen if three components went down? So how do the system continue to function? Or n components will go down. Okay. This is something you have to design your system for, okay, not after the fact. So yet another thing which I guess will not make sense at this point, but as we look at this topic down the road, it will probably resonate better, is the fact that you shouldn't depend on a global clock. In other words, you shouldn't assume that all machines in your system are always perfectly synchronized. Okay? You can use clock synchronization algorithms and other things, but you shouldn't depend on the fact that there is a global clock in the system. Okay? It's an important issue, but we will come back to this for it to make more sense. Okay? This might not make sense without much background into distributed systems. Okay? Now, there are several techniques you could use to scale your system. Asynchronous communication. You shouldn't have to wait for somebody to reply to you for you to make progress. Okay? This allows you to make faster progress. So you use instead of synchronous communication, which is what you may have used for most of your programming, should use asynchronous communication for better scalability. Okay? When we talk about architectures of web servers, we'll see how asynchronous communication can help improve performance of web servers over something that uses synchronous. Okay. Better distribution. Okay. If you use better distributed algorithms, better distributed data structure, that always helps you scale better. And you can always use either replication or caching or some combination of the two to scale better. Okay. If all else fails, start caching is what people say. Sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. And we'll see real examples or rather examples of real systems where caching does help and somewhere it actually doesn't get you as much as you would hope for. Now, these are general principles that people use when you design a distributed system. Okay. So now let me give you a little bit of history. Okay, there is maybe 20, 30 plus years of work that has gone into this whole field of distributed systems, and systems have evolved over time from the very early days to what they look like today. Okay, so and this slide also shows you some of that evolution. Okay. So early distributed systems basically use what is called the mini computer model. Okay. I'm pretty sure most of you haven't even seen a mini computer. But maybe 25 years ago, the way you had computers where you had these mini computers which are timeshare systems, and you had this dumb terminal, okay, the VT100 terminal that was connected to this machine. There are tens of these that would connect to each machine, and each user would have to then go onto a console and log in and do something. Okay? And there were rudimentary networks that connected these machines together, and you had applications that worked over this network. A very early example of a distributed application was email. Okay? So you had modem lines where you send off a message. Okay, in this case, it's an email message, and then the machine would actually dial up another machine directly. And then you would have a connection established, and then you transfer that mail as if you are doing an FTP, and then the mail would then appear at the other machine, and then it would be delivered to the user. Okay. So you had this very rudimentary network that depended on dial-up lines. Okay. So you can think of what you can do with a network like that. I mean, not that much, but that's how you could basically write distributed application. Most of the processing was local. Okay. So all you could do was basically use this rudimentary network to access files or databases that were stored on other machines. Okay. The computation was not distributed. Storage could be distributed because you could use a network to download a file, for instance. Okay. Very early forms of distributed application. Okay. Maybe 10 years after this model became popular, there was this other model called the workstation model. Okay. So in this world starts resembling more of what you actually even have today. People could afford to buy workstations of their own. The reason they couldn't do that then was computers were very expensive, so you couldn't really put a machine on everyone's desk in those days. Okay, but as the price of hardware kept dropping, you could afford to buy powerful workstations that you could put on everyone's desk. Okay? And some of these machines are more powerful than what individual users needed. So what researchers thought was, why not use or harness all of the resources on everyone's desktops? Or workstations in this case, and make that a single large distributed system. Okay? So that led to operating systems like Sprite, which allowed you to submit a task, and then the system would decide on what machine to run that task. Okay? So you fire off any command on your machine, and your OS would say, okay, there are these three machines idle, so it would actually migrate this task to some other machine, execute them, get the results, and display them to you. All done transparently to the user. You can even think of, you do an ls on the command line and it's executed somewhere else and you get the result. It doesn't matter from a user standpoint, but what it does for the system as a whole is it enables better resource utilization. Right? Because you are harnessing idle cycles on other machines to do some useful work. So that led to the client server model. Okay, so in the client server world, you have two types of machines. Okay, clients, which are less powerful machines, and servers that are more powerful. Servers provide some useful services to the users. Okay, and users access these services to client machines. Okay, that's basically what a client server model does. And this is still a very popular model today. Okay, practically everything you see today, like the World Wide Web or anything else, follow some form of the client server model. There are servers that provide some services. In the case of the web, these are web servers, okay, that run all the applications that you use. Okay, everything from online banking to e-retail. Okay, and clients access them through local workstations. In this case, they access them through a browser. Okay, the browser is the client that runs on your machine. Okay, and this is used for everything else like file servers, print servers, database servers, and lots of other applications. Okay. A concurrent model to the client-server model is what's called the processor-pool model. Okay. In the client-server model, it is assumed that the client has some capability to run a component of the application. In this case, it's the client side of the application, say a browser. Okay. In the processor-pool model, this is also called the thin client model. Users still have a machine that resembles a desktop, but this is a very stripped down desktop. Okay? It's very limited capabilities. All you can do is run some graphics. It has some graphics capability to display some things to. Anything you do is actually sent to a server for processing. So there's a pool of processors in the back that does all of the processing. Okay? In other words, the client functionality that would run on the workstation is actually most of it is being processed at the server end, not at the client end. Okay, this is what you call a thin client model. So there used to be what were called X-terms or diskless machines, okay, that had some limited capabilities to do graphics and do input-output keyboards and mouse and whatnot. But all of the processing was handled in the back end. Okay. You will see that, so this is also referred to as the fat client model, where the client has more capability. This is referred to as the thin client model. These two always compete with one another. Every few years, one of them makes a resurgence. Okay, so most recently, this thing has come back in the form of virtualization. Rather than having your desktop run your desktop OS, there are some companies that are actually putting your desktop into virtual machine and running it on a backend and just giving you a very simple client that just can do simple graphics and do have keyboard and mouse and whatnot. This makes it easier for your organization to manage your desktop because they're all centralized on some servers. So there's this tension between the fat client and the thin client model. And as I said, every few years, each one makes sort of an appearance in some new shape or form. So if you now think of smartphones, okay, that will start resembling this model. Because what you have on smartphones are more limited capability. You may have some apps running, but most of what the app does is interact with the user. All of the heavy duty processing is pushed to the back end. If you take an iPhone app or any smartphone app, that's how things work. You do some limited interaction and then it just sends off a request. It's handled on a pool of servers, not necessarily a pool of processors, but a pool of servers in the back end, and you get back a result. That's an example of what a thin client would do. Okay, in this case, you're
pushing towards being a full client. Like they have now, like real browsers and graphics cards and everything.
Correct.
Crazy.
So that's exactly what I was saying. As the capabilities of clients grows, you migrate from this model to that model. So if you 5 years from now, your smartphone may have 4 processors. Okay. So your smartphone will be able to do a lot more than what it can do today. So some functionality can move back to your client. In this case, it's your smartphone. But what you can do today requires some back-end processing. Okay, so what is the line that divides the client and the server is what keeps changing. Okay, the more you do on the client, the more you are on the fat client world. The less you do, more you are in the thin client world. Okay? All right. So here are some other models that are in use today. There's a cluster computing model. What this does is it basically takes a cluster of servers and that are interconnected by a high-speed LAN or a local area network. Okay? And then you run some application on this cluster. Okay? This could be everything from distributed web servers to scientific computation to enterprise applications. Okay? Databases and payroll and accounting and Spire, all of them run on some cluster. yeah, which is connected by LAN. Okay. That's referred to as the cluster computing model. So your server is basically not a single machine, but a cluster of machines. That's what your cluster computing model does for you. Okay. What grid computing does is that it takes this cluster of servers and it connects them over a wide area network. Here you have a local area network connecting your servers. Here you have a wide area network. So your machines may be separated by a wide area network or even the internet. Okay. So in other words, in a grid computing model, you have a pool of servers that are distributed geographically, then the network that is connecting them is a WAN, or in this case is the internet. In this case, you have a cluster of servers that are connected by LAN. That's the primary distinction between what we will call a cluster computing model and a grid computing model. Okay, is this clear? Now, taken to the extreme, the grid computing model also starts resembling applications that you may have seen, like SETI at home. Okay, where you have a screensaver app that runs when your machine is idle, and the screensaver app talks to a server, gets some work, does some local processing and returns those results. What you have essentially done in this scenario is you are harnessing the compute cycles on individual desktops, not necessarily servers, that are really spread across the internet. And you have thousands of them that are collectively donating their cycles to do some useful work. Okay, so the applications like SETI at home, what they do, I mean, the application is not important. So what is important is how do you take the grid computing model to one extreme, and that extreme is rather than having, so let me just draw a picture. So the cluster computing model is basically a rack of servers, okay, that has a LAN connection. Okay, if you take several of these, okay, and then you connect them over a WAN. Okay, so you have in this case three clusters that are geographically separate. You have WAN, or in this case this is the internet. You get a grid computing model. Okay, so pools of servers that are connected over a wide area network is the grid computing model. Taken to the extreme, instead of having these pools of servers, what you have are individual machines. It doesn't work. Okay, so you have these pools of machine. In this case, they could be desktops that are connected over a WAN, rather than groups of machines or individual machines, you have an extreme form of what is called a grid computing system. Okay, is that clear? So this is just an example of an application. What would you do with this? Okay, so this SETI at home is just an example of an application where users donate cycles, or users donate their machines for some larger distributed application. So what happens in this case is you download a screensaver. And whenever your machine is idle and the screensaver kicks in, it's not a real screensaver, it just looks like a screensaver. It's a program that's running in the form of a screensaver, and whenever your machine is idle, it contacts some server and says, I am idle, give me some work. Right? And then the server would send a small task to this machine, and then you would compute that in the program, send back a result. Okay? So SETI at home, SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. What this does is it basically takes all of the data that's read by radio telescopes all over the world and tries to process this data looking for any intelligent signals out in space. And since there's a lot of data, you need lots of machines to do this. So what these people did is, rather than buying a humongous machines that would have cost them a lot of money, they said, let's ask for users to donate cycles on their machine. That's all it's doing. So it's doing a distributed application using donated CPU cycles. Okay. Now, there are other forms of distributed systems that are some combination of all of these. Okay. So, you have WAN-based clusters, okay, that look like grid computing systems. These are also referred to as distributed data centers. Okay. Large applications like Yahoo, Google, Amazon, that all run on these WAN-based clusters. Okay. Looks like a combination of cluster computing and grid computing in some shape or form.
How is that different from grid computing?
How is that different from grid computing? The difference between grid computing and a distributed data center really lies in administrative control. In a grid computing model, typically each of these clusters is owned by different entity, and they're all connecting it together to share resources. So I have my compute cluster and someone else has their compute cluster. And sometimes my needs might exceed the size of my cluster, but that cluster has idle cycles available. So we share resources. Okay. So each of them may be a data center, But each is owned by a different entity and they are sharing these resources. In this case, all of the data centers are owned by a single entity. So Google has set up multiple data centers that are all doing Google tasks. Okay, so there's no, the sharing is between Google's application, not Google's application, someone else's application. That's really the difference. Who owns those machines? In this case, a single entity owns them. In this case, different entities come together and share those resources. But in the physical form, they look exactly the same. They're clusters that are connected over a WAN. Okay?
I have a question about secure code. So does the user get to know that what application is running on the back?
Does the user know? Typically, you do know because you are the one, you go register at some site and download a screensaver. So you can pick your cause, right? So, I mean, there's cancer research, there's genome sequencing, there is search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You can pick whatever cause you believe in and donate your cycles to that cause. There are also more generic forms of this where you can just say, I don't care, I want it to be used for something good, and you basically leave it to someone else to figure out what task will be assigned to your machine. But typically you would know.
That's highly risky, right? If someone could
yes. Into your machine about it. Yes, so in this case, the question is about risk. In this case, you have to trust whoever you have signed up with is not going to do something bad. If you donate your cycles to a botnet that some criminals are using to do something bad, that's not a good thing. So you have, there's some implicit trust assumed between whoever is running the application who is donating the cycles. Yeah, so that goes without saying. Okay. So there's virtualization and cloud computing. We'll talk a little bit more about this as we go along. So these are other instantiations of some of these models. Okay, but let me talk a little bit about some stuff that you may not have thought.
What would DRBD come
with? What would what?
What class would DRBD come
with? DRBD as in the storage replication protocol?
Yes,
right. So what would DRBD come under? DRBD is basically, one model that I have not introduced with the client-server model is the peer-to-peer model. Yeah, that's also an important model. So applications like DRBD fall under the peer-to-peer model. Because there are two peers. Now, neither of them are clients, they are both servers, they are equal machines. They are talking to one another. So it's sort of more a P2P model. Okay, we'll talk about P2P models as well in this course. So here are some other examples of distributed models. So these are what are called distributed pervasive systems. Okay? So here you have small nodes rather than large nodes with some networking capability that act together in concert. Okay? So what this is basically saying is computation is everywhere in some shape or form. Okay? So you have devices that have some form of computation. Your phone has a tiny computer, your laptop can do computation, your home router is also, broadband router, is also has networking capability, has a CPU on it. So if computation is everywhere, that what this allows you to do is come up with what are called pervasive applications. Okay? These are everything from TiVo to your Windows Media Center to smartphones, iPods, car-based PCs. So in other words, computation has become so inexpensive that you can embed a chip that has a CPU on it at a very low cost in any device that you want, okay, and put a network on this chip, a wireless communication with wireless communication capability, and then any application that you run on it can communicate with some other application and get a distributed application. Right? So basically anything that you see today, even TVs that you buy today, yeah, all these high-end flat-screen TVs, they have the computers on it, they can stream audio, video from the internet and decode them and display them locally. So even these machines are becoming some form of a network computer. Yeah, so this is basically where the world is headed. In other words, computation has become so inherent in the environment that you don't think of these devices as machines. They are actually doing something else, but they have computational capabilities, storage capabilities, and networking capabilities. Okay, so you get all these other forms of distributed system that you wouldn't have thought were traditional distributed systems. Okay? So there are sensor networks and healthcare networks that are also part of this. I think I'm going to run out of time, but let me just do this slide and then I'll stop for the day. So uniprocessor operating systems. Okay, so now what I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about operating systems. Thus far we have talked about distributed systems in general, but a significant portion of this course focuses on operating systems as an example of a distributed system. Okay. So to understand a distributed operating system, we first need to understand what a uniprocessor operating system looks like, and then we contrast that with a distributed operating system. So any operating system, whether it's uniprocessor or not, basically acts as a resource manager or an arbitrator. Okay? So it sits between the hardware and the user. Okay? It's a piece of software that sits between the hardware and the user, and it provides an easier to use abstraction of the underlying machine to its user. So when you deal with your machine, okay, via the operating system, the operating system has hidden lots of things from it. It has hidden the precise amount of memory that's on your machine. You don't really know what speed your CPU needs to run on, all of the underlying hardware details of the disk and all the I/O peripherals. All of that is hidden from you. You interact with the machine using higher level abstractions like files and applications and so on. Okay? So what this has done, what our OS has done, is provides a virtual interface to the hardware that's easier to use than the hardware itself. So you don't need to know a lot of these underlying details. Okay? That's what an OS does for you. Okay? It's a resource arbitrator that provides this higher level abstraction for your underlying hardware. Okay? And now what are uniprocessor operating systems? So these are, as the name suggests, operating systems that run on a single machine. Yeah, typically a single processor machine. And all early forms of operating systems were uniprocessor operating system. That is no longer the case today. Okay? Today you would be hard pressed to buy a single core machine. Even low end laptops have become dual core. So by default, most operating systems, modern operating systems, are multi-core or multi-processor operating system. But early operating systems are all designed to run on a single processor. Okay? This goes back all the way to MS-DOS and early Unix, okay? which were what are called monolithic kernels, single OS kernel that managed all aspects of what an operating system should do, okay? Manage all of the hardware that was on the machine. Okay? From there, these operating systems evolved to what's called a more modular or layered design. Okay? So rather than having one large monolithic kernel, you had a more modular kernel that had sub-components and pieces and modules that made it easier to write an operating system, maintain it, and incrementally grow it over time. Okay? So this is just a software engineering artifact of how to better design a uniprocessor operating system. Okay? So now, from that, these operating systems are evolved to what is also called a microkernel architecture. Okay? So in this architecture, the kernel itself is very small and compact and provides very bare-bone functionality. Okay? That functionality being safety and inter-process communication, and all of the operating system functionality is actually implemented as user processes that run on top of this microkernel. So even things like memory management, CPU scheduling, the file server actually run as processes, okay, individual processes. And what you have in what you typically consider a kernel is a very small piece of code that basically allows these things to communicate with one another. In a monolithic kernel, all of these would be components of this one large program that we call the kernel, and they communicate with function calls. Okay, you can basically, the file system can talk to your device driver and so on through functional call. Here you have to communicate through messages because all of this code is actually in user space. Okay. There are several instantiations of the microkernel architecture. The early forms of Windows NT were based on the microkernel architecture. Mac OS X is also based on the microkernel architecture. But it's a hybrid, it's not a pure microkernel architecture, and there are reasons for that we will not go into now. Okay. They're mostly performance reasons. So that's very quick overview of a uniprocessor operating system, and I'm going to just introduce distributed operating systems and stop. Okay. So what a distributed operating system does, okay, as you sort of contrast it to a uniprocessor operating system, is it manages multiple machines. Rather than a uniprocessor operating system is responsible for managing the resources on a single machine, A distributed OS is responsible for managing resources on a multiple machine. But from a user perspective, a good distributed operating system should and does not look any different from a uniprocessor operating system. It looks exactly the same as a uniprocessor operating system. It hides the fact that there are multiple machines it's managing. So a good distributed operating system essentially looks like a centralized OS but runs on multiple independent CPUs. So basically it's making lots of things transparent to the user, the fact that there are multiple machines, that they're connected on over a LAN or in a WAN is all hidden from the user. That's what a good distributed operating system does. Now there are very few commercially available operating systems that actually strictly follow this definition. They break some of this transparency. In other words, they do not hide lots of these details and the user actually knows these details. Yeah, but that's what we will use as a definition for a distributed operating system. And what I'll do next time is give you the many flavors of a distributed operating system, from the one that actually follows this definition strictly to ones that don't and actually expose lots of the details of the underlying hardware to the user. Okay? But because we have run out of time, I'm going to stop here and we'll continue next time. Okay? So before I stop, for those of you who want to enroll in this course but have not or were not able to, pick one form from me, okay, fill it out and I'll sign it and we can just hand it in for to get you into the course. Okay?